I'm at the Game Developer Conference today.
What's the mood at the Game Developer Conference?
There's definitely a lot of people looking for work and more activity around studios trying to get consulting gigs. So it's not as hot as it was last year, but last year it was all crypto, and it's kind of nice not to see any of that. This year, a lot of the independent studios actually sound pretty excited, and the fact that there's a lot of stuff changing is kind of showing up as a lot of opportunities. So it's actually more optimistic than I thought it would be.
You don't need no optimism, Alex, because you got talent.
Welcome to People vs. Algorithms, a show about patterns in media, technology, and culture. I'm Brian Morrissey, and each week I'm joined by Troy Young and Alex Schleifer as we try to connect the dots about what's happening in the worlds of media and technology. This week, we have a conversation with Kyle Chayka, a writer at The New Yorker and author of the recently released book Filter World, which explores how algorithms are flattening culture. This is a topic Kyle has focused on for years. It's something that I used to call algorithmic sameness, and I saw it mostly in publishing. With the loss of control over distribution, publishers needed to create content not just for people, but for the needs of algorithms first and foremost, whether that algorithm was from Google, Facebook, or more recently TikTok. I mean, even the most hyper-aware can fall into the trap of shaping their content to please whatever the algorithmic god of their persuasion demands. And to me, it's not just the story of algorithms, but the ecosystem that exists around algorithmic media, and in particular, the overemphasis, in my view at least, on optimization. I mean, once you're in the algorithmic fighting pits, the only way to compete, seemingly, is through optimization or growth hacking. A generation of media has been largely defined by finding growth hacks before the algorithm catches up. And this cat and mouse game gave us such cultural treasures as You Won't Believe What Happens Next headline conventions, the monotone TikTok voice, and the interminable backstories we get before we can finally read the recipe. And yet, as a consumer of media, I have to admit that algorithmic recommendations are a cheat code. I happily give away my discovery of new music to Spotify's algorithm. I never spend a lot of time working on a finely tuned taste in music, so outsourcing that's wonderful. I mean, I suspect many people don't have time to wade through the stacks at vinyl record stores. I mean, as Troy says, it's easy to fall into an anti-algorithmic viewpoint. It just doesn't seem very cool to admit that you prefer to give over to some computer code your preferences and cultural products. And yet, I believe most people happily make that trade-off. I hope you enjoy this discussion with Kyle, which comes after we discuss the plight of the middle manager and whether you should trust the people shaping the AI world. And also, we hear from Graham on the Rant Line. On that note, you can send us a question or a comment on the Rant Line by visiting memo.fm/PVA. You can then hit record and send us a voice message that we'll use in a future episode. Thanks a lot for listening. And if you like this show, I regularly meet people who are listeners, which is always a terrific experience. Please send us a rating and review wherever you listen to your podcasts.
Our game has gotten some good responses. We've changed
our show.
We've changed our studio name to Human Computer, and that got a good response as well. So, and we announced.
Hold it. That's a lot of news. That's a lot of news.
Just dropping a lot of news.
The news.
So, well, I'm rushing through it because you sound like you're totally disinterested, Troy. So I was trying to speed it up.
Hey.
I like that you guys are quarreling.
You need to talk to your guy about that. Don't do that. That's dysfunctional. Listen, what was the name of your previous studio?
Unient.
Universal Entities, yeah.
Universal Entities, that's right. Shortened to Unient. Okay, and now the new one's called Human something?
Human Computer.
Isn't that taken?
No, we own Human Computer LLC. It's ours.
Oh, good for you.
Does it matter if you get a URL anymore? I called it the rebooting because I couldn't get reboot.com, and now I realize.
Well, the URL is different things. I mean, our URL is, if anybody wants to visit it, is humancomputer.io, But yeah, we re-registered the company and it was all available.
That's
cool. So we're very excited.
When will I be able to play this game?
Q4 2024.
And do I need to be an advanced gamer to be able to play it?
No, our first game will not be for advanced gamers. Okay, it'll be for noobs. Noobs like you.
Well, I'm not noob. I did Asteroids and
Oh, cool. It's come a long way since Pac-Man.
I got a Ms. Pac-Man, excuse me.
Oh, the better ones. Yeah.
Yeah. My mom got addicted to Ms. Pac-Man once during our childhood. It was like a very brief period. She was playing it like nonstop.
The genius thing about Ms. Pac-Man is that they essentially repackaged a very similar game, but they just put a bow on top of Pac-Man and called Ms. Pac-Man. It's incredible.
They changed some stuff, like the treats were different.
The treats were different, yeah.
It's a great game. Okay, so a lot of optimism, I guess some optimism.
Some optimism.
Not as much fear and loathing there.
I think independent studios, I mean, it's the same thing as everywhere in media. Smaller companies or individuals that have a low capital intensive structure, are pretty flexible, are distributed, and have a bit of time to figure out what's going on, are seeing this as an opportunity. You know, you have more access to talent. You get kind of this renewed focus. If you're a big studio with like hundreds of people or your cost structure is through the roof, then you're struggling a lot more. So we're seeing similar trends in gaming. So, but most of the people we hang out with are in the smaller space, independent games. And of course, you know, Apple and Netflix and the big platforms are here talking to these small publishers because you never know where the hit's going to come from. It's been very interesting.
Was there a lot of AI talk?
Yeah, there's been lots of AI talk. Ubisoft, I think, also demoed something where they had fully AI-generated characters that would have conversations with you that would fully generate it. So they're starting to demo agents. There's some anxiety around the amount of junk that we will see on game stores with AI just being able to generate lots of trash games that can then flood the market. But if there's 40,000 games being released every year on Steam, for example, we're really competing against 0.1% of that because most of that is just trash that nobody plays. It's not to disparage the work of people doing games that aren't successful, but a lot of these are essentially just Unity kind of asset rips that you just package and try to sell for $2.99.
Hey, Alex.
Yeah.
Now that Brian has given in and given me a subscription
to
rebooting, can what? I get a free copy of the game?
I'm going to pay you for your game because I value your labor, Alex.
Thank you. I appreciate that. Well, it depends. If we are on Apple Arcade or Netflix, it might just come with your subscription. So, you know, it might be free.
Oh, great. So, yeah, I'll get it that way. Thank you. Mm-hmm. I don't get Brian's product as a bundle, some kind of bundle, but maybe, you know, who knows?
Optimistic.
Brian, do you want to bundle your stuff with my game? We can be the next New York Times. You got games.
Maybe.
You got insightful content.
SEO content and whatnot.
Yeah.
Okay.
It's great.
Speaking of SEO, I don't know if
you've been jamming a lot of shit behind the paywall, Brian.
Well, I mean, I need to give tangible benefits to people who support the work, those who pay. And there's different ways to support.
I feel molested by the thing. It's filled with ads and now it's behind the paywall.
Now, the dual revenue stream is, I've never gotten a complaint about an ad. They're very tasteful.
Just scroll through.
I think they're additive. Did you guys see the OpenAI CTO Miro Mirati interview? I guess this stuff, it speeds up so much that I think it might even be out of the news cycle at this point because there's so much stuff. But basically, she was being asked in a Wall Street Journal video interview about where the data came from for Sora. I mean, it's a video, AI video generator. We all know where video is on the internet. It's on YouTube. And she's basically asked, does it come from YouTube? She got this funny look on her face that quickly became a meme because you could see the lawyers seizing control of her. And she was like, I don't know. She's kind of funny. This is going to be a major issue for these companies.
She makes the world's most complex machines, but sadly, she skipped PR training.
Yeah.
Troy, right? Like you felt the same way I did, I guess. When I saw this interview, I was like, how does she not have an answer to that? Like a perfectly constructed answer to that question. They knew it was coming.
Were you PR trained at all, Troy, or did they just give up? Or
are you
kidding? They tried.
I've been PR
I'm trying to imagine that.
It's kind of you get this dog from the pound that keeps pissing on the floor and is kind of a lost cause.
Poor Allison Keane.
Yeah,
Allison, but, send me a note. I want to know how.
Yeah,
the
of course. I've been
PR training was
many
for
times.
Troy.
Can't you tell in my polish?
Yeah.
She was a little sloppy. I think that it also shows maybe that we're at this sort of in-between time when nobody really knows what to say about fair use. The whole market is struggling with what's the right answer to the question, which is like you gobble up the internet to train your model and somehow it seems more poignant when it's tart, when it's focused on video, which was the...
Well, it's more obvious, right? I mean, a lot of Silicon Valley in business, as far as I can tell, is based on plausible deniability, right? Yeah. And you can plausibly deny a lot of things. When you build on video, you can't plausibly deny that you're using YouTube video. It just doesn't pass any kind of smell test by any sentient human being.
I think we're moving into this long period of figuring out how to price human effort around content. And it's going to take a while, right? So we don't know, because I think maybe partly because we don't know how much the other side of it's worth, meaning what's the value of that content to the creator of an AI platform. It's hard to price the inputs, and it's going to take years to figure out like how much we pay for farm to table versus industrial content production via an AI bot, and how pricing differs between different types of content, and the limits of fair use in a use case that I think hasn't been, that wasn't conceived of, frankly, when fair use was created.
There are a couple of like interesting things here. One is, it looks like this stuff's going to have to go to court until somebody has an answer, because nobody wants to make a statement, right? Not even Sam Altman or the CEO. They don't even have a big statement where it says, this is what we believe. It's really interesting. And
I don't understand why they just come out and be like, look, we believe in fair use. We have an incredibly expansive definition of fair use. Anything that is public data is fair use to train on. Obviously, YouTube is public data. We train on that. The New York Times, public data. We train on that, et cetera, et cetera. If you want to sue us, fine. But this is what we do.
Right, but think about the audience here. They could say that, and maybe YouTube could have even said that when they were showing clips of CNN on it in the beginning, or somebody playing a song. I think those were corporations fighting corporations. Here, if OpenAI comes out and says, yeah, of course we rip YouTube, we think it's fair use. Now you have thousands of YouTube creators, right? You and me, everyone, looking at OpenAI as ripping off the content of people. This is not YouTube versus Google. So I think part of the timidity, that's my hypothesis, is the fact that if they go out and say that, they're not going to make a lot of friends.
Okay, well, get a better answer before they're hauled in front of Congress, because that is where this is going. They're getting hauled in front of Congress. Congress loves to do that. They love to get the clips out. And so...
You know, Brian, but Sam Altman performs so well in the PR ring.
Oh, he's very likable.
That it's hard to compare the two. I thought he was unbelievable. He did another Lex Fridman this week, and he's so fast and so he's really transparent, actually, but always has the seemingly the right answer on it, you know, at his fingertips. But did you listen to it? There was a question where Lex asked Sam if he should be trusted with the kind of terrifying potential of AGI.
Was he like, no?
He's like, you know, we need governance, and I'd like to think that I could be trusted, that I've shown that I'm trustworthy, but you can't rely on a single person ever. The system has to create checks and balances. So
let me ask you this. How important is it that he be trusted, and that a lot of the people who are building this be trusted? Because look, Elon Musk is out there. He's open sourcing Grok, and he's suing OpenAI for dishonesty. And they've got a name problem, right? He's trying to redefine open, the open in AI. And a lot of that's esoteric to regular people, esoteric like tech talk. But I think it does speak to, let's be real. I mean, we saw this with the social network, and it didn't dent Zuckerberg. There's a lot of playing fast and loose with rules that's baked into the system. It's ask, not even ask for forgiveness afterwards. It's just take what you can and then deal with the consequences down the line when you have enough lawyers and whatnot. And honestly, I think YouTube sold to Google because they just needed the lawyers. Does it matter that if Sam Altman is quote unquote trusted?
It's ridiculous to think that a CEO of a, you know, important technology company needs to be trusted on some level. And on some level, the governance systems within that company, particularly there's cascading systems of governance, right? So like the board has to be a check for Sam Altman, as does his management team inside of the company. But as we've seen, the board can be moved with money. Effectively. And so to me, they have to live in a bigger system of governance, which is regulation at some point, when a question is when and how. And I think that the open source idea is an important check here. It's that if you imagine that this is actually a era-defining kind of technology, if it is anywhere near something that is sentient or the power that can kind of replace humans, surely it can't be dependent on an individual or a company. It's got to be a societal asset. It's like discovering DNA. You know, it needs to be part of, I mean, now people will take advantage in different ways to wring commercial value out of it in different ways. I think that's fine. But I think that the open source idea is really important here. I really do. You know, it's the same with all stuff with Elon. He's like a fuckhead, but he always often has something important to contribute to the discussion.
That's a great review of him. Well, yeah. let's move on to a different topic.
And what are you talking about? Alex isn't going to bite on that?
No, I think he's weary of the Elon stuff. I don't want to talk for Alex.
You know, I don't want to say anything about Elon because whenever I criticize him, I'm just called derangement syndrome?
Elon derangement
syndrome? Well, naive first and then
deranged. Yeah, naive is for the different reasons for that.
Naive and deranged.
I think Elon, I don't think it's particularly genuine, because if he ended up having OpenAI merged into Tesla, he wouldn't be so upset about it. However, irrespective, I'm finding him deeply uninteresting and I'm starting to get a sense of what this guy's about. The OpenAI stuff, the thing that's kind of quirky about it is that it's such a messy structure, and it's a lot of promises from, as we know, human beings who are fallible. It could be like the most important company of this generation, and yet we don't really fully understand how it's organized and who runs the show. So I think that's just messy. I would like it to be just a little bit more transparent. I don't particularly need it to be open as such. That being said, I think most of these models are going to be pushed towards open source. Apple's efforts seem to be entirely open source because they know that the value that they'll bring and that they'll take out of their customers is not going to be the LLMs. So I expect a lot of this stuff is just going to go open source. Now, when it comes to AGI, it's all hypothetical, right? It's like a conspiracy theory on the internet now that AGI exists and is controlling Sam Altman to get integrated into Microsoft to take over the world, right?
Like, really?
Yeah.
I like that.
Yeah.
That's a good one. But you got to give him credit because, I mean, to me, Sam Altman sees ahead of things and he understood that, you know, he said at one point in this podcast that in the future, there won't be a kind of governance capacity inside of the company, whatever you'd call it, safety and what would the
trust and safety.
Trust and safety. He said the whole company is trust and safety. At some point, like 90% of what we'll do as a company is manage the broader impact of our technology on society. Also, remember that Sam Altman took no equity in the company. Why? Both anticipating that either A, he was already wealthy enough, that B, this would give him an incredible platform of influence, and that no one could accuse him of being profiteering off of something that should have societal benefit, or C, that he could find other hustles off of being Sam Altman that would create new investment opportunities. And it really didn't matter because he would be wildly rich through the whole process. So there's a lot of stories to tell around all of this, I think.
Yeah, I hope there's a movie.
Yeah.
Who would play him? Michael Cera?
Yeah, that's actually a really good one. I really like that.
Okay. I think the interesting thing though with right now with the content being ripped from YouTube is that I don't expect us to hear anything from YouTube because they're also facing the same issues.
It's everybody like the Spider-Man meme.
And they're kind of all like, it's some sort of standoff at the end of a cowboy movie.
Well, meanwhile, in my like private dinners that I do in between webinars, there's a lot of discussion of AI and payments and
are we moving into a conversation about middle management?
Well, yeah, but most publishers just throw their hands up and be like,
let him segue, man. What the hell? He was just
that was a segue joke. It was a great joke.
It was a great joke. You're just like the guy that like speaks over the comedian just before the punchline.
Yeah. Heckler. I'm a heckler.
Yeah, not even a heckler.
In your media training, did you get told on the panels not to be like, oh, well, that's like what we discussed in the pre-call? I was like, no shit, that's why I'm bringing it up. Anyway, let's just talk about middle managers. They're all getting offed. And Troy wants data, but Bloomberg crunched the data. Look, I know that nobody cries for the middle managers, but then there's studies that show that middle managers are necessary. And Bloomberg crunched the data.
Whatever the case, they're people and they're an important part of the economy right now, you know?
Yes. You pull out the middle managers and you've collapsed the post-World War II sort of white-collar professional class, because that's what it is. Like very few people, for all this talk of the entrepreneur, it's a very small group of people. And, you know, most people do not have the wherewithal, the risk profile to go off on their own. And
well, that's not just entrepreneurs and middle management. There are other roles in the world.
Yeah. There's individual contributors and there's craftsmen, there's trades, there's all kinds of things.
Discipline leaders. There's experts.
What are disciplined leaders?
Well, it's kind of management.
Sounds like something a middle manager calls themselves on LinkedIn.
It's more defined by mentoring and expertise than it is about coordination.
Right, but it's like four of those.
You're one of those, aren't you?
Sure, and I'm not sweating. But yeah, no, I mean, it's really brutal. We're seeing it in tech here.
Is it brutal?
Yeah, because I think it became a... Even when I was at Airbnb, I could see this kind of environment where the company wanted to focus and become much better at prioritizing. Troy, you've been in companies. You know how hard it is to prioritize. Companies always do too much, right? But then you look at your organization, you say, well, of course, we have all these like smaller leaders and they all want to own something. And it creates an organization that's working on 100 different things at the same time and not moving in unison. And so you start saying, well, how do we change that? And it's like, okay, well, it's to remove these leaders and focus on more senior leadership that runs a team of people who make shit, right? Whether it's whatever it is you're making. And that was a trend that started for me then, I think. And now it's been just accelerated because the economics kind of forced us to rethink it, because technology is showing us that, I think working remotely made it happen. Like, wait a second. You could have, everything's happening over Slack. People can kind of just get their work done. Do we need all this? Do we need all these layers of abstraction between the person making decisions and the person making the thing?
Who are we crying for right now? Listen, I know you guys want me to be the sort of callous participant.
Argument. It looks like you're volunteering.
No, but let's get a little more specific. Brian, I know you like to identify with middle management, but like
I like to identify with the cubicle class. That's below middle management.
Okay, but cubicle class are people that actually do things.
Yeah.
What is minimal management to you?
So I used to go around the editorial meetings at a place I worked and identify people who wrote emails wrote stories.
So the metric is email volume?
Well, if their main output is emails and meetings, yeah, you're a middle manager. I mean, Mark Zuckerberg, you know, when he was talking about his year of efficiency, and a lot of this cascades from Silicon Valley, it just does. Managing the people who are doing the work.
I think you could define it as like a person a few levels within the organization that manages 3 to 8 people, that has oversight over a tiny part of the organization.
Someone types something into Perplexity.
Well, I mean, but the thing is, like, that manager class became important when companies started scaling and you were bringing a lot of young people in that you wanted to kind of like put to work. And so you needed to set up this kind of system of like 8 or something people to one manager. And then on top of that, the consultants would come in and create these org structures and say, and it started defining becoming a manager as a career progression. So you start as somebody who does something, and then you become somebody who manages a small group of people who do something. And that's what gets you to becoming a senior manager and a director and stuff like that. But as the companies grew, you started having more and more of these middle managers.
Right. So companies, but Jack Welch did the same thing when he whacked half at, you know, a bunch of people at GE years ago. So is this just part of a cycle? Are we in a tightening era, or is this a fundamental restructuring of business hierarchies such that communication technologies, coordination technologies, and kind of changes in how we think about talent inside of companies is more fundamental?
I think it's three things. Can I list them?
You get two.
She is the best.
Number one is, like, one of the drivers is definitely economics and efficiency. Companies want to become more efficient, and they're cutting back where they think they can cut back. Number two is a kind of a philosophy shift that happened during the pandemic when we started working remotely, where, you know, new technologies, new processes were created that kind of, where it became apparent that you could actually automate a lot of this stuff and you didn't need a lot of this, these layers in between. And number three is a technological one, where companies already bracing themselves and setting themselves up for not only technology that will improve their efficiency dramatically, potentially.
Right. So C.1 on that one, right? Like, it's a wave of efficiency.
But so it's a wave of efficiency, but it's also, on top of that, it's a existential risk. There's not one company that says today, like, we don't know if AI is going to really help us thrive or completely destroy parts of our business. And so that is kind of creating this compression in organization that's flattening the organization. And it's a confluence. So it's happening at a bigger scale. It seems to be, right?
Brian?
Yeah.
What's the positive here?
Well, I think the positive is that it could break apart a lot of the soullessness of companies and lead to force a lot of people, maybe against their will, but to, first of all, it will reward people who stayed closer to the work. And I think that is overall a good thing. And I think that we're going to have organizations that are smaller. And by necessity, when you have smaller organizations, you need less layers of management.
Did we have middle management in the olden days? Did the blacksmith have a middle manager?
That's why we need to bring back apprenticeships too, by the way. That's an entirely different episode. We're not going to solve it.
I agree.
Okay.
All right. Thank you.
Let's go into reader questions. I want to get into listener questions.
Yes.
Can we do this?
Yes. The rant line. Are we going to keep calling this the rant line? I think the newspaper I worked at that owned the IP to rant line went out of business. So we may as well just take it. I like it.
Yeah.
So on the rant line is Graham. Let's hear from Graham.
Well, you were convinced no one was going to record one of these, but I'm guessing you've probably got dozens. Also, excuse the noise. I'm out walking the dog, which is something I usually do when I'm listening to your podcast. Question for you all, I guess. I work in the digital learning space. I manage a huge learning management system for a global health company. And I'd like to know your take on the future of human learning and how we teach each other things, how much AI is going to nose itself into that space and supplant people like me.
Alex, do you want to help Graham out with forecasting the future of learning?
Yeah, I mean, AI, I think some of the most exciting demos of AI that feel most, I would say, useful today are AI-based tutorships, AI-based tutors that adapt to your learning style, your level, because right now a lot of content needs to be created to create kind of curriculums for people at different levels, with a different pace, with a different learning style. AI is able to, today, I mean, even if you use ChatGPT, create a learning model for you to learn nearly anything that is accessible over the internet. I have very specific ways of learning things and consuming information, and I had ChatGPT teach me about shaders, which is a type of like computer programming. And it did an excellent job. So I cannot see a future for like textbooks or something like that, where things are set, but rather that you will have these specialized AIs that are into tutoring. The second thing is I'm working, you know, with various companies around AI, and stuff like language learning is really powerful with AI, because AI can not only speak to you, but with multimodal, it can review your pronunciation. It can catch mistakes. It's incredible.
Maybe you could get an American accent.
Never. I've been trying.
You should get a different accent. You get like I'm a South like African Arnold. Accent.
What was the gentleman's name that asked the question? First of all, I really Graham. Appreciate him asking.
Great
Thank
question.
For hitting the rant line. One little note from hustle culture, right? This is a hustle culture corner. One thing I noticed today for all of you is that if you're stuck, go for a walk. Because there's nothing like walking to free the mind. Just saying.
Oh, are we in the good product already?
No. But the question asker, who's his name? What was his name again?
Graham.
Graham was walking his dog when he asked the question.
He was, yeah.
Yeah.
He likes to listen to us while he walks his dog.
And I think it's a great time to walking is, because I went out thinking about Kyle joining the show today and what I was going to ask and all that. I went for a walk and it was just like, boom. That's good.
Okay, well, he's about here. We're going to be talking with Kyle Chayka.
But can I answer the question?
Yeah,
now?
Go ahead.
Is it my turn now?
Right, you did not like my answer?
I loved your answer. Why are you so insecure about everything? Jesus.
Because you call him naive, I think.
Okay, so I got to say, big picture, great. Your platforms will be fine. It would seem to me that more and more education are moving to management systems and all that. But like, I'm totally bearish on formal education, right? Now, admittedly, educational environments are great for maybe mentorship / instruction, community definitely, certification from a brand or affinity or association with a brand. But like, you can learn anything if you're disciplined now. You can really learn anything. You can learn it in with between groups of people. You can learn it from YouTube. You can learn it from online courses. I think there's people will go to college for a long time because there's lots of other reasons to go other than learn, but you absolutely don't need to sit in a classroom.
To be honest with you, were you a good student?
When I wanted to be.
Oh, that's a no, which is fine. I think it fits your brand. And that's the most important thing. But I think that the extra benefits of college are completely overrated. I don't get it because outside of the very elite colleges, it's not like the people I went to college with. I mean, no offense, Jack and everyone I hung out with at Old Eagles. But I don't really think that it was like super beneficial to my career or anything.
I mean, insofar as maybe it acts like a country club where you meet other people and it gives you that cachet, right?
Providence College? I don't know.
Alex is one of the smartest, most resourceful people I know. Did you even go to high school?
I didn't finish high school.
Really?
No,
that's why.
But how did you not finish high school?
To get so testy.
I didn't finish high school. I didn't go to college.
With us highfalutin educated folks.
Oh, yeah, exactly. And I probably missed out. But just like an experiment, folks, for the listeners, okay? If you have a ChatGPT Plus subscription, it's $20 a month. If you're interested in this, it's worth checking out in Perplexity as well. But ChatGPT has a voice mode. You turn it on while you're in traffic or walking the dog. You turn it on and start a conversation with ChatGPT in voice. Now, there's still a little bit of the delay between answers. That's the kind of the biggest gap that they need to cross to make this really, truly useful. But you can start a conversation and get ChatGPT to start teaching you any subject. Try it out. Say, I'm this. I want to learn that. Help me run through a set of exercises that will teach me this. Right?
Incredible.
And it is incredible what you get just out of the raw output of ChatGPT. It is not a specialized tool.
What a tip from the hustle corner. I love it.
Hustle corner. Let me just add one thing, though. I hate to be the negative here, but we all have roles to play. What about being like well-rounded, right? Like where I went to like college, it was a liberal arts college. And I know that's like anathema.
Regional? Which college was it?
Providence College. Is it good? Providence, Rhode Island. It's like when I tell people I went to school in Providence, they're like, Brown? I'm like, no, I crossed out. But not Bryant and not Salve Regina.
What about RISD? Why didn't you go to RISD?
RISD? Oh, the RISD kids were cool. I wasn't cool enough to go there. I mean, they could draw and stuff.
Alex would have gone to RISD. Had
oh,
chosen
totally.
Another path in life.
What's his name? Brian Chesky went to RISD.
Brian and Joe Gebbia from Airbnb both went to RISD.
But we studied like the development of Western civilization and we read books and all this other stuff. Won't this just lead to people being less well-rounded? In many ways, I mean, it's one thing to pick up the skills, or is that just the fate? Like people are going to be less well-rounded.
I mean, sure.
Or the definition will be different.
Yeah, I think that there is computers and access to everything without any friction has a tendency to make us more insular. But at the same time, you could see it as like a recovery of our time and spending our time in more meaningful ways if we make space for it, like individually, as communities, as culture. I'm not saying it's going to happen, but I don't think school or the education system as it is today helps us being well-rounded. People end up in debt. People end up having spent 4 years of their life on something that they're probably never going to use. A lot of kids are not, including me, are not made for the education system. I didn't think school made me more well-rounded. I think school like felt like it was slowing me down. Hey, maybe in the future, we all work 4 days a week. School is about being outdoors and learning how to build shit with your hands. And then we spend 2 hours at the computers and become geniuses. I don't know, but it's going to have to be all these things put together.
I like that. It's a good idea. You should build a school around that idea.
In the morning, you do like survival skills and then you sit at a computer for a couple hours.
Yeah. Oh, Kyle just joined us.
Kyle's here.
Kyle's in the bathroom.
Well, he said he was, there's drilling going on. This is New York. Welcome to New York.
Hi, Kyle. Yeah. It's so good of you to join us from the bathroom.
I mean, it's you wouldn't want to hear elsewhere, I don't think.
But just out of curiosity, is there a chair in the bathroom or are you sitting where I think you're sitting?
I moved a chair into the bathroom.
Good. It's keeping it classy.
We really appreciate it, Kyle. Thank you. Thank you for doing that.
So, Kyle, you're a writer for The New Yorker and you just published... this is your second book, right? Or have you written more?
Yeah, just a second.
Okay. So it's Filter World, and it's about how algorithms flatten our culture. This is something you've been covering for a few years now, right?
Yeah, I feel like since 2015 or 2016, probably.
Okay. So for those who have not read the book, what is your thesis in basically 2 minutes?
The thesis is all in the subtitle of the book, which is How Algorithms Flatten Culture. And I think the overall argument is basically all of our experiences being so dictated by algorithmic recommendations and feeds on digital platforms has made us more passive consumers who don't know where content is coming from and care less who makes it. And the same situation pressures creators of that content, whether it's video or music or visual arts or writing, to kind of conform to the aesthetic standards set up by those algorithmic feeds and the platforms that they function on.
Got it. But has that impacted you specifically and like how you go about, you know, building your own taste? Because I understand like the point. I just wonder whether it's like an all or nothing thing and how you personally manage the algorithms in your life affecting you.
It definitely does affect me. I think anyone who made their career on the internet feels the pressure of algorithmic feeds and kind of catering to the standards of them or not. As a writer, I've definitely felt the pressure of talking to Twitter, optimizing my posts for a Facebook feed or for an Instagram story. And then as a consumer, I mean, I kind of wrote the book to become more aware of how it was impacting me. I think I let algorithmic recommendations take over a lot of what I was consuming, particularly in a music context, because that's an area where I maybe don't do enough work for myself. So I was, you know, letting Spotify shape a lot of what I consumed. And so it within the book and over the course of doing all this writing, I tried to step back from that, find other ways of consuming culture, like music, art, books, whatever.
This is maybe the segment of the podcast where we can hate on Spotify for a minute. I have a rant about that later. But you made me think of something on my walk today, Kyle. And I was thinking, like, because one of the things that interested me is kind of where this goes next and where it would go if you had a say in it. But I was thinking about this thing that I had read that I guess I see this podcast is called People versus Algorithms. So maybe you're happy about that. You've landed in the right place, Kyle.
Very apt. It's
Kyle versus Algorithms.
Yeah. And then I was thinking that algorithms are this kind of emergent global brain, right? Like they're the building blocks of the virtual world. And I was like, it's like they're beginning to assemble the next frame of our reality, meaning like, and yeah, it starts with the fucking Taboola text recommendation, but later it's like Alex in his VR headset.
There's a straight line between Taboola and your VR, Alex.
Yeah. And then, but what I remember hearing this thing that people had thought that Mark Zuckerberg had seen the future clearly when he bought a bunch of NVIDIA chips to build spare capacity, anticipating the demand for AI to power Reels feeds, right? Meaning that recommendation systems in a recommendation culture were actually eating an enormous amount of compute. And I used to just think of them as like, oh, we got to recommend the next article in our CMS. We need a little script to do that. But really, they're the things that power the connection between everything, whether it's an additional piece of content or it's the product you're going to buy next or the algorithm that fuels the customer service app that's helping me do anything with my bank or something like that. So it really is this kind of layer of automation is what I was thinking. And I know you acknowledge that they can be a force of good or a force of evil or kind of both. And I was wondering if it just struck me that it was almost like a layer of cultural automation had been created, right? But now what we could do is live a layer above that, just like we live a layer above automation where someone makes our mac and cheese at the Kraft plant. We don't have to make that with our hands anymore. And it reminded me, because I need to bring in Canada every time I talk on the podcast call. It reminded me of living in Regina, which is the city, the great city where I'm from. It's named after the Queen. And we didn't have scenes like big cities. We didn't have like the cool Williamsburg scene. But we had this ambient kind of din of culture from around the world, mostly delivered to us from like the CBC. And in particular, a late night program called Brave New Waves. And so we took that in. That was our kind of cultural feeding tube. And then we went into our rec rooms in our suburban homes and we made it our own. And so I guess I'm going on here, but I'm wondering if it's just like we're shifting cultural production to a new layer, because I'm super happy right now on the internet, Kyle. And
good for you, Bruce.
Troy's also popping Zen, so.
Yeah. I just find a lot of shit that interests me.
Yeah, why not just give it over to the feeds? I think it's like sort of, what I wonder, this will be my challenge on Troy's thing to you, Kyle, isn't this just kind of the repricing of connoisseurs? Like being a connoisseur takes a lot of time and effort. And now there's this cheat code where you can sort of pass yourself off as having taste without doing the work.
I think that's very true. I think the automation thing is very true. And I think the connoisseurship or taste thing is very true. It's like an automation of taste, of expertise, of cultural connoisseurship. And sure, you can give yourself over to the recommendation algorithm. You could theoretically watch whatever comes up on your Netflix homepage. I don't think you'd be very happy.
Just like we could give ourselves over to the DJ, right, on AM
For
radio.
Sure. But the difference in that scenario is that the AM radio DJ was a person who had thoughts about what they were putting on the radio. Theoretically, like if the radio DJ was a robot, then sure. I like that idea of another person existing in the same reality as you, maybe being in that town, being Canadian, period, and kind of speaking to your perspective, your identity, your life, and like curating something for you. Though I do think it's underrated how much work this stuff takes and how much labor curation needs. Like automating that is very tempting, and I totally get that.
I wonder if you're, because Troy is a person of a certain age with a brain that's fully formed or maybe even in decline, but to me the impact of algorithms is really age dependent. If it was up to me, I would not allow anyone under 14 to be exposed to algorithms because I don't think you have fully fledged taste and thoughts, and it's so easy to manipulate and we're so malleable then. And you see it, right? Like you see CoComelon, this cartoon on Netflix that is essentially algorithmically created. They field tested with kids and edited as soon as kids lose interest, or putting a kid in front of TikTok and watched it. And I think that Troy maybe is beyond that because he was living in Regina with a single radio station. But if you fed this early on, do you think that has more of an impact? Do you think age has an impact here?
Yeah, I mean, you're more impressionable when you're younger and your attention is more liable to gaming. I mean, maybe it's always liable to gaming, and influencers use lots of tricks to game our attention too if we're looking at them. But for the younger generations, it's like, they don't have the chance to exist outside of that recommendation system. Like they don't. experience that scarcity of content that might come when you only have the one radio station.
Right.
And so we like live in this surplus of opportunities to consume and content that's optimized for us to pay attention to it. But it feels like as the optimization has gone up, the like long-term value has also gone down in a way. Like you can watch a TikTok feed for an hour and gain absolutely nothing from it. Like it's
absolutely.
It's ephemeral.
I wonder if people are hyper aware. Like I'm like aware of when I feel like I've been manipulated by an algorithm. And I just don't know if people focus on that. Like I went to dinner last night at Au Cheval and I was like, wait a second, this is a TikTok place. I'm like, everyone here is 20 plus years younger than me and they're all like taking TikToks. I was like, this must be like one of these viral TikTok places. And I was like, oh shit, did I get manipulated into coming here by something that then got passed on to like Reels? But
haven't you always been manipulated by media, Brian?
Well,
I mean, if you weren't, so the algorithm is just our collective conscience. It's not, oh, the tech bros in San Francisco. It is the energy of the collective, right? So yes, is it better to be like some goofball at CGME in Regina who's doing top 20 radio? Or is it better that we're absorbing culture from a collective of people whose tastes are similar to our own? Like, and by the way, I think it's a brilliant thesis to argue and a very important one. I'm not saying that one is better than the other. I'm just saying my kids don't read movie critics anymore. And do they need to?
I mean, we've kind of turned a corner in a way. Like, I don't know that the print movie critic is coming back anytime soon. But what I do find interesting is like how criticism and curation and connoisseurship even have moved into these new spaces. So it's not just like the algorithmic feed is suggesting stuff for me. It's like new waves of creators and interesting people are finding ways to communicate their ideas through those platforms. I've watched a million TikTok video essays on Dune, like breaking down what happened in the movie and how it relates to the books and all of that stuff. So I don't think the algorithmic landscape is devoid of intelligence or expertise, but you do have to seek it out in a different way, I think.
I think there's also, it's so much more potent that the algorithm actually ends up creating culture as much as it, we keep talking about recommendation. It's not like culture is happening, blooming all over the place, and then the algorithm finds what humans are creating. The algorithm is creating the content. Everybody does that stupid face on YouTube. You know, the stupid Mr. Beast face, right? Yeah. Like the tone of voice, the music, the edit is all being generated to fit into the algorithm. And at some point, I wonder, like, how much of that is recommendation and just generation? And this is where I think you talk about this flattening of culture.
Yeah, I mean, I think that's the pressure. So as consumers, like, sure, it's great that we can get our consumption curated by an algorithm. But then the creators also have to fit themselves into that mold of whatever works on a platform or whatever has proved effective on a platform. So I think that's why you get the YouTube face, the TikTok voice. There's this hilarious video of a nurse or like a doctor on TikTok mimicking the hand gestures.
Can you explain TikTok for us? Because I know what you're talking about, but I'm sure some people don't specifically.
Oh man, it's like a very staccato monotone. So it's something like, okay, I went to dinner in Soho last night and I had to get the pizza at this restaurant because I saw the pizza so often on my TikTok feed. It's just like,
yeah.
Oh man, that was awesome. You know what? That was
great. Kyle, there's also an NPR voice, you'll notice, mm-hmm. which is just a good one. Hey, can you explain what the difference is between filter world and filter bubbles?
Yeah. I mean, filter bubble, I was surprised to find, is like an idea from quite a while ago at this point. Like it feels so relevant, but it was coined, I think, in, I don't want to misquote it, but it was either the late 2000s or early
2010s. It was the Upworthy founder.
Yeah.
No, it was Cory Doctorow.
Oh, I thought it was
I'm joking.
It was Eli. That seems shitification.
Yeah, exactly. No, the filter bubble to me was like an early concept of how our own individual consumption could be shaped by a feed. And I mean, feeds have taken over so much more of what we experience at this point. That was not the era of Netflix. Like it was not the era of Spotify being so dominant. So now it's not just like seeing it on our Twitter feeds or our Facebook feeds, but actually in all forms of culture and entertainment. And those feeds have also gotten much more algorithmic over the past decade. So you can see, I mean, with Twitter alone, like Twitter used to be pretty linear. You could kind of depend on how it worked. And now you don't even know how it's working on a day-to-day basis. So
yeah, yeah.
It feels more warped, I guess. Like the filter bubble has become more powerful and warping. And so to me, it's this like immersive environment that we all live in.
So you wrote this article when I was at Airbnb. I think it was like Welcome to Airspace, right? And that was about like apartments becoming starting to look like Airbnb and coffee shops looking the same. And I remember I was head of design there when that happened. And it took that article for a lot of us to realize like, oh shit, because we could pull out all the pictures. And in our case, it was entirely like preference based, right? Because when you wanted to pick a place and you weren't sure, you kind of went down a baseline where it looked clean in a certain way and certain things photographed better. And it created this echo chamber where everybody started looking the same because they would just perform better. And you would all of a sudden, we started digging into all these YouTube videos. It's like, here's how you take your pictures. Here's how you set the thing. And and they had like rules for all that stuff. That wasn't actually algorithmically created by us. So at the time, I didn't feel so bad. But you know,
clearly, you were a protagonist in filter world, Alex.
Oh, I mean, I was 100%.
You're part,
right?
part of the sickness here.
No, I think part of it is like also, you know, we keep talking about how we don't know what the algorithms do to us. Some of these people building those algorithms don't really know why it's showing stuff to you. And because it's like hitting some sort of dopamine receptor. And when you're throwing that at a million people, it works. So I think we're kind of losing control of culture. Yeah. It felt really quaint at the time. The Airbnb stuff felt quaint and kind of quirky. But it's a different world, I think, today. And I'm terrified with AI. I was actually trying to pivot this conversation in AI. So how does that world look in a world of AI where everything's not only a feed, but just regurgitated in some sort of video format or text format that you consume?
Yeah, the AI stuff scares me. But I think, I mean, part of what I wanted to talk about with this book was not just like the algorithmic recommendation per se, but just how digital platforms, period, have performed this hyper-globalization on what we consume. So it's not just like, it's the fact that Airbnb exists, like enables this generic aesthetic. It's not purely because of a recommendation, but people will kind of naturally optimize what they're doing on this platform that collects so many millions of people at once.
Yeah, I don't know the cause and effect. Like, yeah. There's something like the high-end cocktail bar is something I noticed in the mid-2010s where you could be in Tokyo, you could be in Dusseldorf, you could be in London, you could be in New York, and it's the same. There was this sameness that pervaded a lot of these kinds of experiences. And I don't know how much of it is caused by feeds or digital platforms or algorithms, but it's definitely something I've noticed that there's a lot of just similar experiences. But also the reality is within a certain group of people, a lot of people have become very similar. You end up having more in common with someone in Barcelona than someone who lives in your own city or town.
For sure. But like, what is the change that has happened? Like over the 2000s, yeah. 2010s, it is the internet. It is our ability to follow that one guy in Barcelona or for the barista in Williamsburg to follow the barista in Sydney and see how the latte art looks on a day-to-day basis. I think to me, it's like the granularity of globalization changed, where it's not just a corporation, it's not just supply chains, it's like all of our aesthetic experiences have become more similar to a vastly larger number of people all over the world than they were before.
Can I just build on it? Because this is the distinction between bubbles and filter world. Mm. Because filter bubbles are about creating these kind of narratives that are part of a collective, true or not, and believing and a self-reinforcing mechanism inside of a group of people informed by communication technology. And that's what really worries me, because I feel like we're living in this kind of modern fog, and where we potentially have these dueling narratives, none of which are anchored in any sort of objective truth. They're just like, what the fuck do you want to believe? And how do the people around you reinforce that? And some of that has actually nothing to do with algorithms. In fact, there's a paper, I sent it to you guys from the communications of the ACM, which is some computer science organization, called Bias, Skew, and Search Engines Are Sufficient to Explain Online Toxicity, basically saying that the read-write world of Web 1, Web 2, and search engines were enough to create basically the tools of online community building that created these potentially kind of warring factions or these groups that feel really separate from one another. So if the flattening of culture means we all get along, like kumbaya, man, let's do it. But I'm more concerned that this technology is used to perpetuate lies.
Unreality. The reality thing is hard to nail down because it's like if most people's lived realities are on the internet, then what is the fact and what is the distortion? It sometimes seems hard to separate. If your politics are on Twitter, then your beliefs are Twitter beliefs.
Yeah.
Yeah. So you did a social media hunger strike in the book, right? Which I don't know. Did your editor tell you how to do it?
No, I did feel like I had to do it myself. Okay, like
I
both
felt some
pressure. I mean, as anyone who has finished a book knows, it's like the worst slog that you've ever gone through in your life. And so this was like coming toward the end of writing the book. And feeling like I needed to go the full distance, make myself uncomfortable.
Okay, so professionally, you feel the need to be on Twitter and all these feeds, like TikTok and the rest of them.
I think so, particularly with my job now writing an internet column for The New Yorker.
Do you resent the fact that you have to submit yourself to...
It's his chosen beat, dude.
No, but I know, I feel like, for instance, like not to make it about me, but I will for a little bit, is I do not want to be on Twitter. I really don't want to be on Twitter.
You're great at Twitter.
I know it's a burden, but...
Double-edged sword.
Yeah, I know. But I have to, I feel the need have to be on there. I would like to have a more pastoral life.
Mm-hmm. I would too. I mean, I think having covered the internet pretty intensely for the better part of a decade, I'm like ready to do something slightly different. And I am jealous of the people who can write about something that's not online and can have an interesting reporter life and career and not have to deal with the vicissitudes of the next new platform and the weirdest freaks you've ever seen in your life doing something.
So does it become like punk rock to like just completely opt out of all of this?
I think so. I mean, it's not Luddite because I read the Luddite book and the Luddites were much more aggressive and violent. Brian, great book by Brian Merchant. But it feels like to me like a back to the land movement or something, or like a, you know, almost hippie thing to be like, I'm not going to be online. I'm going to cut myself off from all of this. I'm going to find other ways to consume culture, to connect to my friends, whatever. It feels rebellious at this point.
Mm-hmm. But you are a product and a participant in the world of professional media. You're a professional journalist. Did writing Filter World or any of your observations change the way you thought about professional media?
For sure. I mean, my thinking was kind of already changing as many of us witnessed the decline of the 2010s VC media bubble.
You work at a holdout.
Yeah, exactly. I mean, digital subscriptions. But I think like before I started writing the book and like in the mid to late 2010s, I guess, I was really obsessed with what was happening on Twitter. Like I saw that as the reality of the media industry or of culture or of success. And I think doing the book changed that, and also the algorithm cleanse of just like totally getting off all of it for 3 months also helped change that. Just to realize, I mean, I grew up on the internet, like I'm fully millennial internet pilled person.
When did you get the internet?
Probably when I was 10.
Oh, so you are full. Oh, yeah. I was fully formed before I got the internet.
Yeah, which I think it didn't help my life necessarily to be so online.
I think it's harder for those of us who grew up analog to some degree.
But maybe now we're moving into a new analog era.
Yeah, it's like all coming around.
Post-internet.
What do you think happens next? I was really aching to ask you this question. Trying to think about like, shit, what comes after Feed World? Because it doesn't sound like it's going to be good. Or maybe it'll be great. I mean, other than, you know, Farmed Back to the Land, which let's exclude that for a second. what happens, you know,
why
on
are
the
you
internet?
Excluding it?
Well, okay, I get that. We covered it. But is it the natural? I think the obvious answer is the feed becomes infinitely more personalized. That's what AI does, mm-hmm. right? And
so,
maybe,
I mean, do you want to live in a world of like the most generic AI generated art stuff? Like, I feel like the early products of AI generation don't inspire hope in me at all. It's all not very interesting. It's not very compelling. Perhaps it can make feeds better. Like a perfect algorithm would be better if it could be more granular, if it could somehow not push people into herd behavior. But that might also just be a fact of human life. If we're all congregated onto a particular platform, we'll naturally move in a similar direction as everyone else.
But what's a hopeful scenario? What's
I mean, a hopeful scenario within algorithmic feeds, I think, is that they get better, they prioritize more human curation in some way, they let you follow people who are better attuned to what you want to see. I mean, personally, I have more hope for just non-algorithmic consumption of stuff.
Like, what does that look like, Kyle?
Going to a record store. I don't know, some very vintage things. Like, I mean, to me, Substacks and newsletters are pretty non-algorithmic for now. And the fact that I can pay someone $5 a month to write about music in a way that I appreciate is a nice thing for me to do.
Although those bastards, they'll say the opposite, but they're jonesing for the algorithm over at Substack.
Yes. Yeah. I mean, the way that they're moving toward an algorithmic platform is very upsetting and disturbing. And it's not adding value. Like, many people have pointed out, the random followers and subscribers you get from this recommendation system don't really help you that much.
Yeah.
Maybe the future is AI-powered bubbles you just create yourself for yourself. I mean, there's something.
I think we're all going to become the precogs. We're just going to be like immersed in content.
Yeah.
It's super. Well,
24 hours
in the
a day.
Soup. Yeah, like Kyle, that. One of the things you didn't talk about is that much is the whole, the other side of this whole thing, which is the economics mm-hmm. and algorithms owned by platforms. The real problem, other than it's maybe, in your view, turn some of us into zombies. The bigger problem is it's robbed media of their ability to create their own distribution. And that's the bigger problem, I think.
And not just media, but not just journalists, but musicians and visual artists and anyone who wants to reach an audience really faces a lot of pressure and mediation from these systems.
Yeah. I'm getting this sort of sickly feeling from Spotify that it's like too much. It's all greased up. It's all greased mm-hmm. with algorithm juice. I started using Qobuz because I'm a title, like I like high fidelity streams. And Qobuz has a nice balance. I mean, it has very little algorithmic stuff. A lot of it is just they curate and say, this is a good album. And oh my God, that felt good.
It feels cleaner to not deal with these things that are trying to manipulate you. Like in the book I wrote about Adagio, which is a classical music streaming service. And the experience of using that software is night and day from Spotify. You're not getting pushed into stuff. You can click a musician and see their whole back catalog in one click. You can sort by performers. You can sort by orchestra. You can sort by era. The metadata is better. It just shows you how much better it could be for the thing that you're experiencing than it is.
I agree. The bonus question that we didn't ask him, Brian, that we discussed is, should we ban TikTok, Kyle?
Oh, yeah, that's the last one.
I think if we ban TikTok, all of the user problems will just persist in other forms, like Instagram Reels.
Well, there's a market demand for this. I think that the big outstanding question is, I'm sort of with you on a lot of the pernicious impacts, at least from my point of view, of algorithms, but they're incredibly popular. If you put an algorithmic feed versus a reverse cron feed in front of people, they'll choose the algorithmic feed, like 10 out of 10, it seems.
For sure, yeah. Yeah, they naturally drift toward that. And like TikTok proved that it's a powerful tool or like a compelling, addictive product for user experience. The Chinese data stuff, I mean, it's neither here nor there in a way. Like all of the data is being surveilled anyway.
Yeah. Well, it just seems to be like it's all theoretical. It's could they use the algorithm in order to push people in one direction or the other direction. I don't, maybe, probably, if they wanted to.
I mean, I think there's some value in looking at reciprocity of them selling a product to us that we're not allowed to sell to them, right? I think if only that should be looked at. If we can sell each other cars and computers, but maybe not that. So
try to get one of their electric vehicles in the United States. You can't.
The reason America is great, Alex, is because we don't look at petty things like reciprocity as things that define who we are.
Yeah, somebody who grew up in the Middle East, I will disagree with you. But
the last thing I would just ask of you for our listeners is your hustle culture tip of the day.
What does that mean?
Oh man, hustle culture.
What are you doing, Kyle, to write these amazing articles and books and also have your, you know, I don't know, whatever else you're accomplishing in life?
I don't know. My hustle culture tip of the day is pay attention to your subconscious. Like be a Freudian or something. Like when something sticks in your brain for some reason, you have to go dig it up.
Awesome.
That's a good one.
Great. That's nice. A cool one.
Thank you, Kyle.
Yeah, this was fun.
Thanks so much, Kyle, for getting into the bathroom for us. This could be a regular segment.
Bathroom podcast.
you came with headphones and a mic. I really appreciate the effort.
Thank you so much.
You're a pro. Do you always have that lamp in your bathroom? That's dangerous, Kyle.
No. So the bathroom in this apartment, the fan is really loud and it comes on with the light. So I can...
Thank you. This is
There's
New
like
York
a really
City.
Loud this background.
This is very
fan.
New York City. Nobody, by the amazing. Way, I just want to tell you, Kyle, as someone who's spending more time outside of New York City, nobody else deals with this stuff outside of New York City.
Oh, yeah, I totally get it. You know, I've prepared in advance. Like, I thought nice. About the scenario.
This is wonderful. Awesome. Thank you.
I'm going to go
so
listen
much.
To my subconscious.
Yeah, have a good one.
All right. Thank you.
Yeah, bye.
That right. was wonderful. Wonderful.
I love that.
You got to go, Alex. Do you have a quick...
I just wanted to keep things moving.
Do you want to participate in the good product corner?
Yeah.
What's a good product?
What's your good product? Feet. Well, they're useful to get you around.
This is more of a scenario good product or an experience, right? So I was thinking a little about Kyle last night. I was looking at a newsletter, and a newsletter that is the product of our wonderful modern internet world. One of the greats called Today in Tabs.
Oh, shit. I thought you were going to say mine.
Oh, no, I couldn't get to yours because it's blocked by a paywall. And then... So I'm just doing my thing, thinking about Kyle, thinking about, oh my God, I feel like my interests are well served. And in this newsletter, it turns out that Ben Folds, the musician, is divorcing for the fifth time.
Oh,
and I thought, well, that's interesting. And it's costing him a huge amount of money, more money than I would have thought that Ben Folds who has. Seemingly sort of faded into the background. But no, he's busy. And I read about it a little on Scoop Nashville, which is a niche publication, I guess, documenting the trials and tribulations of folks in Nashville. So he's an interesting guy, Ben Folds, and he's an advisor to the National Symphony Orchestra, has been for a bit. And then I really remembered, oh my God, how much I appreciated like his kind of brand of quirky, nerdy, thoughtful pop rock, right? And I started thinking about all the other bands I liked at that time, you know, the Lemonheads or Elliot Smith or Ben Queller or this underappreciated Canadian band called Sloan or Postal Service, Fountains of Wayne, all these bands, right? And I started just sitting in my chair, going through an old catalog of music, of course, that was infinitely available to me because of modern technology. And it just made me connect all these things, like the piano tours that came before Ben, Randy Newman and Todd Rundgren or Elton John or whatever. And I fired up the songs and I listened to them through Qobuz, because I'm kind of over Spotify, and I spent an hour kind of reliving old times. And the whole experience of like random discovery, going back, reliving that, no one bugging me, was a great product. Not just a good product, but a great product. And three songs I played from Ben Folds, the one called Philosophy, this soupy kind of pop perfection of his song Brick, or like that, you guys know the song Rock in the Suburbs, which is like kind of driving pop rock. And while I was in that listening, I was in that newsletter and I came across another account, and I hope you looked at this, Alex, which was this guy, also randomly a Canadian, called the Tom John. And he had, this is the perfect kind of companion to the whole feed world thing. He had done a TikTok video in the same voice that Kyle projected earlier, like the fast talking kind of TikTok thing. And he did a thing where the video was entitled something like "How to Listen to Your Favorite Song Whenever You Want." And what he did is he did this whole setup in his room of using a rotary phone to call a radio station, to tell them to play a song for his girlfriend, to take that song and plug his Walkman that had a radio in it in and connect it to his tape deck, to record the song from the Walkman onto the tape deck, and then to put it onto another mixtape because the tape deck had two tapes in it.
I enjoyed it, but it was not that complicated to record those songs off 97.5 WYSP.
Okay, Brent, like, it's a video, man. It's entertainment. The point is that it used to be a lot harder to do certain things, to listen to that Ben Folds song over and over and over again. And that's the internet. It's an amazing place, and I'm grateful for it.
I definitely did that. That was a good product. My good product is Chicken McNuggets. I made my own version of Chicken McNuggets, and they were outside.
That's so funny. We did the same last night.
Did you?
Yeah, my kids did.
Yeah.
They're a little dry, actually.
Well, you're not doing it right.
You know what? If you want a backup good product, I will only tell you, I thought you guys would probably criticize me for it. Shake Shack, man. Oh my God. The Smoke Shack burger.
Really?
So good. And their milkshakes.
We do In-N-Out here. We're very happy with that.
In-N-Out.
Although it is a Shake Shack.
Thank you all for listening. And if you like this podcast, I hope you do. Please leave us a rating and review on Apple or Spotify or wherever you get your podcast that takes ratings and reviews. Always like to get those. And if you have feedback, do send me a note. My email is bmorrissey@therebooting.com. Be back next week.
All right, guys. Well, thanks so much. I've got to go meet with folks at Unity right now. So I have to bail. Talk about video games.
All right.
Good luck. Fortnite.
Thanks. All right. Bye.
Peace.